and come.
Good evening. I was going to... we've been talking here a little bit about how rusty we are, not having been in session for a while, and I was going to actually say good morning, not ever even thinking that this would be, that I would be doing this in the evening, in the interim. But first of all, I want to welcome everybody to the first meeting of the High School Redesign Work Group. I want to talk to you a little bit about the word work group and what that is going to mean. I would like everybody to be aware of the fact that we are keeping minutes, and we are recording each of the meetings, and we're going to try to do it, of course we will not be taking any action on anything, so we will not be doing any voting or anything like that, but we can talk a little bit more about the structure of the work groups as we go, but we will continue to call on members and through the chair, but hopefully have just a little bit more open interaction between those who testify and the members. Since this is a work group, we'd like it to be just a little bit more informal. Thank you to those in the audience for coming today. I'd like to talk to just a little bit about the topic here of high school redesign. Obviously, we are 7 years into the 21st century, and there is no dispute I think in our state that technology has changed the workforce, the way that we live has changed our family life, the economy. We are dramatically different as a society than we were 7 years ago. And now, as a member of the education community in this state, as everybody in this room is also a member of, we have been asked and posed the question, that are our high schools preparing learners for the 21st century workforce? Are the skills that they are leaving high school going to get them through these changing times and allow them to compete and allow Minnesota to compete in a global economy? There are some people in the state who have actually characterized our high schools as obsolete. So in response to that, and I thank Representative Mariani, who could not be here tonight, he has convened this extremely timely, very important work group. And at the centerpiece of this work group is high school redesign. We will eventually, I hope, suggest some ways that we could redesign our high schools. But before we jump to solutions, which is actually that's my natural inclination, I feel like I know everything about everything, so I do naturally want to jump to solutions. But I think that we collectively, as the House of Representatives, as a body, and as a state, we need to examine a couple of things. And that we're going to start tonight talking about the changing demographics. I think we need to address what are the skills, define the skills that are needed in a 21st century workforce, and what careers and then skills associated with those careers are crucial in order to keep our state competitive in a global economy. And then, last but not least, we need to address what progress have we made in our state so far in restructuring, redesigning our high schools. After we have discussed some of those topics, and hopefully we'll come to some consensus about what are some of the components of a 21st century high school, then I think that it is our responsibility as a body and a state to provide the leadership, the resources, and the support to help our schools redesign themselves so that we can ensure that every one of Minnesota's graduates can enter the workforce with 21st century skills and compete globally in this changed economy. So, in order to, on your agenda, members, since we've talked about change a lot, I asked the members of this committee to read a book. And the book is called Who Moved My Cheese? And I picked the one for teens since it's high school design. I thought that was very relevant. And much of the committee is going to focus on change. And I was going to begin tonight's discussion with some perceptions about this book and some analogies. But I think what we are going to do instead is we are going to wait and have some of that discussion after we hear from some of the speakers tonight, because they can really help us define maybe what we might think is the cheese in the book, or help us relate to some of the characters in the book just a little bit more. So with that, I am going to go ahead and we are going to start with the first topic, and that is changing demographics in the state of Minnesota. We have with us Tom Gillespie. Tom Gillespie has served as the Minnesota State Demographer since 1979. During that time, he has been involved with a wide-ranging set of issues, applying an understanding of demographic trends in such areas as the state's economy, health care for aging population, welfare reform, rural population change, labor shortages, government spending, and the aging state workforce. And tonight we hope to add to that repertoire where he can take the Minnesota state demographics and apply them a little bit to our current high school population and what that means for our future population. And Tom, did you want Kyle to come down now? Is that the way you like to work together, or would you prefer part one and part two?
Madam Chair, we probably would be best working separately. I think these are separate presentations.
Okay. Kyle just gave you the thumbs up on that. So.
Oh, just have to find it. Okay.
And Tom, while you're doing that, may I just ask the members to go around and introduce themselves? I should have done that, and I also wanted to just make a side note that we did invite members of the Commerce Committee and the 2020 Caucus at the suggestion of Commissioner Segrin and Representative Atkins, which I thought was a very forward thought, and many of them emailed back and said they couldn't make it tonight, but would like to continue to get an invitation to the future meetings, and they'd like to try to at least make a couple of the meetings. So, Representative Brown, would you please start? Introduce yourself.
I'm Robin Brown from Albert Lee.
State Representative Andy Welty from Olmsted and Wabasha County.
Representative Marcia Swales from Woodbury and Landfall.
Representative John Benson from Tonka Plymouth.
And Representative Tom Tilbury from Fridley.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is, can you hear me okay? I don't know if the mics are on or not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. My name is Tom Gillespie. I'm the Minnesota State Demographer. There we go. Thank you. I've been asked to prepare some information about some of the changes that we are seeing in the workforce and also in education in Minnesota, as it particularly pertains to the workforce. I've divided my discussion into three parts. First is a brief examination of the need for a qualified high school graduate, and my belief is that the need is increasing, that the demand for quality graduates is increasing. Secondly, that the demographics of the student population is changing, and third, that that demographic change is also leading to changes in our teacher and other staff cadres and particularly in secondary education. First, looking at the need for quality students. Some would actually refer to this, and I've heard some people refer to it perhaps a little overly dramatically, this is the perfect storm, but clearly there are some major forces coming together in our society, not just in Minnesota, but in the nation. And in this, Minnesota really fairly closely resembles the nation in many of the characteristics of age structure and change in our workforce. The one area that we are quite different from the nation is that we are starting as one of the most fully employed economies, not just in the United States, but in the world. It's not just Minnesota, but it is Minnesota and all of our surrounding states. Minnesota ranks second right now in the employment ratio. That's different from an unemployment rate. The employment ratio is the proportion of the adult population that actually has a job. And Minnesota consistently is in the top two of states, and all of our neighboring states are in the top seven of state. So this is one of the most fully employed areas of the United States as well as the world. This workforce is aging. This is something that's been going on for a long time, and we've known, of course, ever since they entered the labor force that they would age. sort of a regular process. And 20 years ago, I would say, well, some of these changes are going to happen in about 20 years. And 10 years ago, I would say, well, they're going to happen in about 10 years. And now it's, well, they're here. They're about to happen. And we are going through an aging process, and there will be some, very soon, some dramatic changes in the structure of our workforce. If it were just that we were going to lose more older people at the upper end of the workforce, that would not be the issue. The perfect storm is that this is also occurring at a time when we will have decreasing numbers of high school graduates and decreasing numbers of young people available to enter the workforce. And as a result of that, future growth will depend increasingly on the productivity of young workers, the quality of the education and their ability to translate that quality education into a high level of productivity, a world competitive level of productivity, will say a lot about our ability to compete in the world economy. This process of aging is something, as I said, has been going on for a long time, but there will be a dramatic change, I believe, within the next year. The average age of retirement nationwide has for some time been somewhere between age 62 and 63. The number of Minnesota workers turning age 62 next year, 2008, will be approximately 30% larger than the number turning 62 this year. That is a dramatic and unprecedented level of change. That number will continue to increase rapidly over approximately the next decade half. Each year, more and more people will consider retirement and will be approaching that retirement age. At the same time, more and more people will be reaching that retirement age not this spring, but next spring, in a little over a year, the number of high school graduates in Minnesota will peak, probably for many of us in this room, for the rest of our lives. We will see a gradual decline in the number of high school graduates. And this is not because of a lower graduation rate, but rather because simply there are simply fewer young people. And if we look at the number of young people age 18 to 24 in Minnesota and the nation, we see that the trend is not just a Minnesota trend, but is in fact a national trend. Some of our neighboring states, such as Wisconsin, is already experiencing a decline in the 18 to 24-year-old age population. Minnesota will begin to experience a decline in this population within the next couple years, and that is also true for the nation. And that decrease in the number of 18 to 24-year-olds will continue throughout the next decade. The competition, I believe, and many of the, if not all of the colleges and universities of Minnesota, and many of them from around the country, believe that this will greatly increase the competition for young entry-level workers as well as for college students. And this will be a keen competition. It will be a difficult competition, and it will be a competition with a very large prize at the end, because if we can attract people here, the best, if we can keep our best and brightest and attract the best and brightest from the rest of the country, we have a good chance of keeping them here after they graduate from college. If we lose them now, we may have lost them forever. And so that is a very keen competition that we'll be facing for the very best and talented young people in our society. Fewer older people, more people retiring, fewer young people available to enter the workforce, and as a result, the workforce will grow at an ever slower pace. Now, the projections here are in the gold bars out to 2030. may be appear at this time to be a bit optimistic. This is not a pessimistic projection. This is perhaps an optimistic projection. And the future will depend very much upon this migration of people into and out of the state for jobs, both domestic migration as well as international migration. And the number of young people available to enter the workforce will continue to decline, and the number of older people leaving will continue to increase, and the what I refer to as the natural increase in the workforce, which is that difference between young people entering and old people leaving, that will actually turn negative this next decade for the first time in the history of the state. We live in some dramatic changes in some dramatic times. Now, economists have long pointed out, going back hundreds of years, that there are two ways that an economy grows. You either increase the number of people making stuff, or you increase the amount of stuff each person makes. One has to do with the size of the workforce, which, as we see, will not grow as fast as in the past. The other has to do with the productivity of the average worker, and that productivity of the average worker will become an increasingly important source of growth in our economy. And this is a point that was pointed out by the National Governors Association at a special meeting 2 years ago that I believe most, if not all, governors in the nation signed on to, pointing out the relationship between productivity, the quality of young people graduating from our schools, and productivity and the implications of that for growth and prosperity within our society. At the same time that our workforce is changing, our students are also changing, not just simply declining in numbers, but they will also become increasingly and are increasingly a diverse population. If we look at a cross-section of enrollment by grade in Minnesota, the enrollment, at least for last year, this is for the 2006-2007 enrollment year, grades 9 through 12 were approximately 20% larger than grades 1 through 4. And as you can see, there is a substantial difference in the number of high school students versus primary school age students. One of the things that we know fairly regularly is that young people tend to age about 1 year every 12 months, as most of the rest of us do, and the children in fourth grade this year will be most likely in fifth grade next year and sixth grade the following year, and it's a fairly regular process, and the children that young people that graduate out of high school will be replaced by ever smaller cohort until this kindergarten class that we see down here, first grade and kindergarten children, the children that this year are in first and second grade, is slightly larger. So there will be at some point a bit of a reversal on that trend, but still the numbers will be substantially less than they are today. And the students taking the place of the graduating students are not only fewer in number, but they're also substantially more diverse. Looking at racial and ethnic diversity as defined by the federal government, there is a strong relationship in Minnesota between age and racial and ethnic diversity, with our children far more diverse than our older population, and our schools are far more diverse racially and ethnically, and not just racially and ethnically, but also in language and culture and national background and in many other aspects of their life, much more diverse than the older population of Minnesota. And Minnesota is one of the most remarkably successful states in the country. We rank number one right now in the number and the proportion of our adult population that has a high school diploma, with nearly 91% of our adults age 25 and older with a high school diploma. That ranks first among all states in the nation. We also rank highly in many other measures of economic progress and graduation rates and education outcomes, and there's much that Minnesota can be proud of in terms of the achievements of our schools. But one thing that we do see is a substantial difference in outcomes by race and ethnicity within the state. And the caution I have here in particular is that the very groups in our student bodies that are increasing, the Black or African American, American Indian, Asian, and Latino populations, are those with the lowest levels of educational attainment. And the future would indicate, unless we can turn some of these relationships around, unless we can change some of this calculus, the future seems to indicate that our relative ranking nationally will begin to deteriorate from first position to ever lower levels of educational attainment, unless we can change this relationship. And finally, not only will our students change in number and in characteristic, but our teachers are also going to change. The Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, Kyle will certainly talk to you, Mr. Uboff will talk to you more about their results, but one of the things that they do is the projection of jobs and turnover by occupation. And one of the things that they pointed out is that Minnesota will need a lot more teachers to replace those that are about to retire. That it is not so much a growth in the total number of students in the total demand for teachers, but in fact a change, you know, a dramatic change in the retirement proportions and turnover of teachers. And this is something that is also being observed nationally, and there's many other comments along this line. The National Education Association has predicted that we will need more than 2 million new teachers in the next decade, and there are many other dire predictions about the number of teachers that we have available, and particularly the number of teachers in certain specialty areas such as math and science and other areas that have remarkably marketable skills to the private sector. If we look at, at Minnesota's current teaching cadre and current employment in the K-12 education, that if we ask the question, how many people, what proportion of the labor force by occupation of people who work in the schools, what proportion will be age 58 and age 62? By 2010, that's 3 years from now. 58 was chosen because that is the average age at which teachers retire nationally. That was the result of the latest NCES teacher follow-up survey in 2005. 58.1 years of age. 62 is approximately the age at which people begin to retire in the general workforce. And so somewhere, even if we increase retirement age a little bit, somewhere in there, we're going to have a substantial number of people retiring. Approximately 30% of secondary school teachers will be eligible to or potentially think about retiring within the next 3 years. School administrators, approximately half will be considering retirement within the next 3 years. But it's not just teachers and school administrators. It also includes people like school secretaries. You know, the people that know how to run the fax machine and the Xerox machine and know where all the files are, you know, and sort of hard to run things without them. School librarians and school janitors and school cooks and bus drivers and many other occupations will see a similar kind of very large-scale turnover within the next few years. And with that, I will end my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Gillespie. Questions from members? Comments? Concerns? Representative
Wilson. Thank you. Dr. Gillespie, there was a lot of discussion during the session about the learning gap. How is it, do you see that Minnesota seems to have a more serious problem with this achievement gap than apparently other states have? Does it have any relationship to this demographics, the percentage of the people, the general population with a higher educational attainment, and is that any reason why there seems to be such a differential?
Madam Chair, Representative Vincent, much of the growth in our minority populations is occurring with migration, largely related to the labor market. People move here for jobs, and they tend to bring their children with them. Much of this movement is international in nature, and so many of the children speak languages other than English at home, and that that can have a dramatic impact on at least initial performance, and also simply the disruption of moving from one area of the country or the world to another. As I understand it, can also have an impact on performance of the children. That perhaps explains part of the difference, but I'm not convinced that it explains all of the difference. And there, I am not an education expert, and would need to defer to someone that understands that better.
I can follow up.
Yes,
Are the immigrant groups who are coming particularly to Minnesota unique to Minnesota as far as percentages and their historic backgrounds in some way? Because when you think of California and other states along the southern border, there are large numbers of people who speak other languages in the home.
Madam Chair, Representative Vincent, the immigrant population, the foreign-born population of Minnesota is a bit different than it is nationally. In the first place, we are we have a substantially lower proportion of our population was born in another country than we see nationally. States such as California and Arizona and Texas, Florida, New Jersey, New York all have very high proportions. Minnesota is not one of those states. By comparison to our surrounding states, we are a bit more internationally diverse than the Dakotas or Iowa. But we are not one of the major destination states for people. However, the mix of people is quite different. Nationally, immigration from Latin America, particularly Mexico, comprises nearly half of all immigration to the United States. And Minnesota is a much, much smaller proportion of people. Our immigration is more diverse. We receive a substantial number of people still from Asia. Asia is one is the largest single origin of immigration to Minnesota. Minnesota is one of the few states that Africa is a major destination or major origin for. And we receive people from both East as well as West Africa. It's not just one or two countries. There are several countries. But in this, Somalia and Ethiopia are the two largest countries. But the third largest source of immigration to Minnesota is India at this time. So we are a bit different from the rest of the country in that regard.
Further questions?
Madam Chair, can you look back at that one slide that says competition for future college students and workforce will increase? And can you explain that again for me? Because I'm wondering, when you say that, is that due to competition that our Minnesotans will be leaving, or are we competing against the whole United States, like the whole country, or are we competing against people overseas and so on?
Madam Chair, Representative Tilbury, this is looking specifically at the 18 to 24 year old age population, which is still the predominant population for colleges and also for labor force entry age. These are particularly important people to look at for the future workforce. It is a group that I think many people look very closely at. The colleges and universities do like to maintain their enrollments. There's large fixed costs and other aspects of their operations. And when they look at these numbers, they tend to see that if they do nothing, if they do not get into this competitive world with other states, that and other universities, that their enrollments will naturally decline, as well as being in an increasingly competitive world for students, that they would be doubly jeopardized by that, because of competition from other facilities and other universities. Employers also view this in much the same way. The employers who particularly hire young entry-level workers are very concerned about their ability to maintain their workforce for entry-level workers. Now, the international market is for students and workers is an add-on to this. And here, much of the rest of the world is also going through an aging process. Europe, Japan, the People's Republic of China, Canada, Australia, much of the world right now is similarly seeing an aging process, and either is already seeing a decline in the 18 to 24 year old age population, or will soon see a decline in the 18 to 24 year old age population. And that leaves really only a few corners of the world that are not experiencing that kind of change. So this is a change that has raised some concerns in higher education and also in labor market analysts. It is one that we perhaps don't know what the full implications of this are in the long run, because, well, in some respects, this has never really happened before on a worldwide basis in the long run. That there have been spot instances of this, but we don't really know what the full implications are. So, but almost certainly it has an implication for college enrollment and for entry into the workforce.
At this time, would you say that college admissions are at their peak? I mean, it seems like it has increased. So currently. So you're predicting that the pool obviously is going to get smaller, and then how would they replace that, in your opinion?
Madam Chair, Representative Tilbury, there is the option, public school, there is the option of increasing the proportion of people who attend college. Many people do not attend college. And by increasing that, we can increase the relative pool. So that's certainly one option. However, in general, a student does need to graduate from high school before they can be a college, unless they're taking AP kind of advanced placement kinds of courses. That is one option, that and individual institutions, of course, have the option of out-competing their competition, and I'd like to see Minnesota. I mean, I'd like to see Minnesota colleges and universities out-compete our competition in every respect, including being able to attract the best and brightest here, who may, once they graduate from school here, also continue in the workforce and move us forward with a very highly skilled workforce.
Any other questions? Comments?
I just have one more.
Oh, sure.
Okay. What you have explained to us, I mean, it definitely makes sense, and we can see the numbers. But what confuses me then is we kind of contradict ourselves, because we lessen our student aid to students to begin college, or it costs more. And those are the kinds of things that I'm having a hard time understanding, because you even said earlier that we knew this was coming. And yet, when we make our decisions, it doesn't seem like we're listening to it.
I'd just love to have your comments on that.
Madam Chair, Representative Tilbury. Something that the state economist, Tom Simpson, and I have pointed out over the last few years is what appears to be a potential for a growing competition among the various segments of our budget. We have within government budgets basically the three largest components of state government budget nationwide is higher education, K-12 education, and health care and social services. And as the population ages, that health care and social services, which is to a large extent on autopilot, we have programs that are set up to pay out in a certain way and to react a certain way to a demand that as those populations as our population ages in total, that we will have an ever increasing demand for these services and that has apparently over the last couple decades been somewhat at the relative expense. You know, this is not absolute expense, but the relative expense, the relative proportions of K-12 and higher education.
Thank you, Dr. Gillespie. Any other questions? I find these demographics alarming, as I think you indicated, Representative Tilbury. And one of the most profound statements that I have actually heard and given now a second and a third thought to as I was listening to this is, Dr. Gillespie, you talked about the 18 to 24-year-olds and what an important part segment of society they are to us. And I have an 18-year-old. And I just sent him off to college, and I don't think I've ever told him that.
Madam Chair, I tell my son that he's precious. He usually rejects that. But I think he is.
I would agree. And I just don't know, as a state, are we really truly getting that message across to our high school students and to our college students, how important they are to this state. So thank you for that. Thank you very much. Next we have Kyle. Every time I say your last name, I say it a different way.
That's right.
Apas?
Yes.
Okay. Kyle is the, I just used the first name this time. Kyle is the regional analyst and outreach manager with the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, in other words, DEED. He is responsible for the dissemination of the labor market expertise through DEED's five additional labor market analysts located throughout the state. The reason that we invited Kyle is that because he can take what Dr. Gillespie has given us, some of the changing demographics, and talk about it, how it applies to the future workforce. And he's going to give us a two-sided approach to this. He's going to give more of the urban-suburban approach, and then he's going to also talk a little bit about the rural workforce. And he is, at least from what I have talked with him, from what I have heard from him on the phone, is he talks about those two things as being very different. So, and I think we run into that quite often here at the legislature. So go ahead. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Uphoff. As noted, I work for DEED, and my job is indeed to talk quite a bit about economic information, particularly as it pertains to the labor market. And as such, Tom has talked about today really deals with the supply side of the labor market, how many potential workers there are going to be to fuel the jobs that we have available. I'm going to talk now about something a little different. I'm going to talk about the demand side of the labor market. As you might guess, labor market really is a stool with three legs, the population and labor force, which Tom talked about, and that employer element. And, of course, these three things are very, very tightly interlinked. We can't have quality economic development if we do not have good workforce development. Indeed, you get out to places in rural Minnesota, the question very often is not, are we producing good jobs? The question, are we going to have actual people to fill those jobs even if we get them? So this is a very big issue for us, this issue of demographics. We have quite a challenge ahead of us in Minnesota. Minnesota has a very diverse economy. When you compare Minnesota's economy against that of other states, we're very diverse. We have a lot of different industries here. That diversity also pertains across individual regions within Minnesota, and that's really what this map shows. Of course, a lot of us are aware of a lot of these types of industries. We know there's a mining industry in northeast Minnesota. Traditionally, northwest Minnesota has been an agricultural economy. What a lot of people don't know is that 50% of the snowmobiles produced in the world are produced in northwest Minnesota. Of course, the metro area has a medical device industry. We have renewable energy in southwest. We have a healthcare industry in southeast. So you have a very, very, very diverse economy stretched across the state. And as you would probably imagine, if you're going to have this kind of diversity of industry, that is going to translate into a diverse workforce needs. All these different industries need different occupations. Those different occupations require different types of skills. And I guess if I were to use an example, take a snowmobile manufacturing plant up in northwest Minnesota and compare it against a pacemaker facility down in the Twin Cities. Both of those firms are going to need some pretty common workers in some cases, engineers, IT workers, drafters, but they're also going to need some very specific workers. Perhaps the plant up in northwest Minnesota is going to need welders. Pacemaker facility is going to need electromechanical assemblers. But even if you take those occupations, which are common between these two industries, there are going to be differences there. For instance, engineer working for that snowmobile plant is going to have to know something about the complex environmental conditions that these machines are going to have to work under. Of course, a pacemaker engineer is going to have to know something about the complexities of the human body. So you can even see, while there are shared characteristics, shared occupations, the kind of skills and knowledge that are going to be necessary are quite different. What makes this an important issue when you talk about rural areas versus the Twin Cities is that the Twin Cities has a very good, thick labor market. When Medtronic needs another electrical engineer, they can maybe get that engineer from another company, and maybe that other company doesn't necessarily need that person or replace them. They can also go all over the world to look for that person with that specific level of training. When you're talking about a company in northwest Minnesota, they may not be able to find that engineer, period, much less that person with those specific elements of skill and knowledge. It doesn't have a thick labor market. There's only a few labor centers or a few employment centers up in that part of the state. So that's what makes it so important, skill development anywhere in Minnesota, but it's especially important in places in rural Minnesota where they're really having trouble retaining a lot of their workforce. One of the tools that we have available to talk about the diversity of our economy is something called the Minnesota Job Vacancy Survey. We've been doing this survey since 2000, and we basically ask employers, how many positions do you have open right now, and what kinds of people do you need? So how many secretaries do you need, how many engineers do you need, etc. We had around 60,000 job openings in Minnesota the last time we did the survey, of which about 42% are in rural Minnesota or greater Minnesota. What's interesting is that there are similarities and there are differences when you talk about greater Minnesota versus the Twin Cities. Some of the similarities are listed here. Healthcare. Healthcare comes up again and again and again. When we started doing the survey back in 2000, we identified healthcare shortages. We're almost certain there were healthcare shortages going on well before we started to do the survey. So, healthcare practitioners and technical, these are folks like registered nurses, LPNs, doctors. Healthcare support, things like nurses' aides and orderlies. Also, community and social services education. These tend to have relatively equitable levels of demand no matter where you go in Minnesota. However, you start looking at some other occupational groups, these are where the differences start to show up. The first thing you notice is that there are far more job vacancies or a higher percentage of job vacancies in white-collar occupations in the Twin Cities. So things like engineers, business operations, these are things like accountants, computer jobs, management jobs. The other side of the coin, of course, is that in greater Minnesota, you have a lot of blue-collar sorts of job openings. Construction, installation, maintenance and repair, transportation and production jobs. Production jobs being those that are predominant in the manufacturing industry. I guess the one point I would make from this is not some kind of an indication that we shouldn't necessarily prepare people for four-year degrees out in greater Minnesota. Like the engineering example I used earlier, these occupations are absolutely going to be critical in any part of Minnesota. The problem there is we need to find a better way to retain a lot of these people after they're trained. However, I would say the bigger point is that there are a lot of jobs in greater Minnesota requiring a fairly high amount of skill, often blue-collar, that a lot of times we're not doing a very good job of communicating to our youth that these jobs are available, maybe to get a two-year degree. In some cases, not even a two-year degree. Sometimes it's just long-term on-the-job training sorts of things. So very often when I talk to employers in greater Minnesota, they are telling me, we can't find welders, we can't find machinists or CNC operators, or a lot of these sorts of occupations. And as Tom noted, the way that Minnesota and the United States is really going to compete really has to be through productivity. And the only way we're going to achieve higher levels of productivity is if we have a highly skilled workforce who are prepared for these kinds of occupations. This next slide, I'm not going to really talk about any detail. I just wanted to give you some examples of the kinds of occupations that are behind those big occupational groups that I mentioned earlier. I'm going to shift gears just a bit. Everything I've talked about up to this point has been relatively current. What is going on in our current economy in terms of demand? What I want to talk about next is projections. What do we think is going to happen in the future? We think in Minnesota there are going to be 370,000 jobs created in Minnesota between 2004 and 2014. That does not count 680,000 replacement jobs. So replacement jobs, these are jobs that people may move out of those occupations. They go on to do something else, something different. They may open up because people leave the state. The biggest factor, though, is that people may retire and leave those jobs open. So replacement is a very important thing to take into account. What I have in front of you right now is a table showing projections for various occupations for greater Minnesota, although these projections, at least trend-wise, match up pretty closely with the Twin Cities as well. The first thing you'll notice is that each of those bars has two colors. The blue component is new growth. So there's a new jobs that didn't exist before 2004. The maroon component is replacement. So for some of these occupations, it's pretty much what you would expect to see. Food preparation, sales, building maintenance, these sorts of jobs have a high replacement component because typically people have these jobs for a while and they hopefully move on and move to other higher paying occupations as their careers progress. So we expect a pretty high replacement component there. But some of the other ones like healthcare, production, installation, maintenance and repair, architecture and engineering, some of these are positions that we really believe have a very high retirement component. Especially when you talk to folks over in the Department of Transportation, they'll tell you that they're very worried about their situation for finding engineers over the next few years. And as I mentioned earlier, I guess the second point I would make from this chart, this is a chart showing greater Minnesota. The next thing you'll notice, there's going to be a lot of occupations, a lot of opportunities for a lot of people over the next 10 or so years. There's going to be a lot of opportunity there. The key point, though, is that if employers, like our snowmobile manufacturers, aren't getting the people they need, like the engineers, none of these jobs or fewer of these jobs are going to materialize, as these companies will hold back hiring. They may even relocate out of some of these areas. So that's one of our biggest fears over at BEAD. Some of these things I'm not gonna cover just to save time. The last thing that I wanted to talk very briefly about is skills. And skills is the element that we know probably the least about. What kind of skills are we going to be needing in the future? And this just gives you an idea of what some of those broad skills are going to be. The first four skills you'll notice are things we've probably heard about all the time. Reading, listening, speaking, writing. Basically, the ability to communicate in the workplace. Again and again and again, when I'm out talking to employers, these are the things I hear constantly. We need workers who are able to communicate. Some of the other ones are kind of interesting. Active learning. Active learning basically means you never get to quit learning. Nobody quits going to school. Once you get your high school diploma or your two-year degree or your four-year degree, you have to keep learning because technologically things are changing so rapidly that really learning never gets to quit. Other things like critical thinking, coordination, instructing, these are really things relating to the knowledge economy. It means we're going to require a lot of people out there who are able to problem solve very well, people who are creative, people who are innovative. The knowledge side of this, I'm not going to go into any great detail, but I do find it interesting. There are things there like customer service next to mathematics. Not two things that many of us really think at all are related. What's interesting, again, talking to employers, they'll often tell me that we can find really excellent technical people, great engineers, great programmers. The problem is they can't talk to our clients. In an age where we're in a globalization situation, the types of products and services we're producing are having a higher and higher technical component. Those folks have to be able to talk to clients more and more often. And it goes the other way, too. Sales representatives, customer representatives, they have to also be able to speak this more technical language as well. So you can kind of see some of these skill and knowledge requirements are kind of going up together. By the way, the clerical in there basically means everybody has a keyboard. Nobody gets away from keyboarding anymore, no matter who you are, any occupation. And with that, I'm just going to close it. There's a few things that we are working on at GEED to address some of this. Right now, we're working on some developing materials for high school students, showing them that there are regional careers, regional opportunities available. I'm designing some web pages and some publications. And I think with that, I'll conclude this portion. I was asked to just briefly run one other very quick presentation here, and this will just take a few minutes. This is a presentation that was shown recently at Minnesota's or Deeds Regional Forums, and it gives you kind of an interesting view on Minnesota's, U.S.'s place in the world economy. Wouldn't necessarily be skilled enough for those jobs. So, not quite true, but occupations are shifting rapidly. The real lesson here is to create good problem solvers who are active, lifelong learners. And with that, I'll conclude my comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Members, that that slideshow on Did You Know, that is available. You can see that on the DEED website. I don't know if many of you have seen it. It's been widely widespread on the Internet, I guess, and many people have seen it, except for me, when I saw it a couple of weeks ago. But I thought it was fascinating. In fact, just a little side note. Correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Epoff, but that was prepared by a teacher in Colorado, correct?
That is correct.
Yes. Questions, comments, or concerns? Members, any questions?
I have a question about the numbers of persons being born in India and China. So, you know, there's a big debate about the effects the population has on global environment and all. Is there any sense in which this documentation is reporting to say that countries with populations the size of the United States simply will be uncompetitive? Or is it saying countries like the United States are moving in a better direction because of the environmental limitations maybe that modern technology is placing on society?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I think the purpose behind this presentation was really to give an idea of really the kind of the enormity of what the United States is up against. As you're probably aware, there's an awful lot behind this that's not being said. Obviously, for instance, we are not at any time going to shift all jobs over to the United States. There are very good reasons for this. For one thing, China does not have the necessary skills to take all U.S. jobs. What this is really it's a wake-up call. We work in an environment now where competition is wide open. I think we're in at one point there was a study that said China had created hundreds of thousands more engineers than the United States did. However, you talk to a lot of groups like the McKinsey consultancy, they'll say that really only about 8 to 10% of those engineers are of a grade that an American company would actually hire them. However, it is a good warning that these countries are going to catch up. They know that they have to improve their educational system. They know that they're going to have to do this in order to compete with the United States. From an environmental perspective, it's a little bit different. It's not something that I'm necessarily an expert in. There are a lot of people who believe that the environment in China is being damaged to such an extent that economic growth and population growth will actually deteriorate over the coming years, and I think that is definitely something that they need to that they definitely need to pay attention to. Similar things have been said about India. So I guess I would just say that this presentation is really just to give you a sense of the enormity. There's an awful lot in this country that we are doing right. There's an awful lot that we're doing right. Our educational systems are the envy of the world. People still send their people to come to our universities. So we're doing very well at producing that level of the workforce. But it does warn us that we also cannot be complacent.
Representative Swell.
Thank you. When you talk about the shortages of skills, one of the things that I don't see addressed here in your presentation is the need for learning languages other than English, and how is that translated into a lot of the research that you've been looking at?
Right. Adam Chair, Representative Swales, this information that you received on skills, quite honestly, this is not my optimal These are not necessarily the kinds of skills that I would study in doing an analysis like this. These came from the federal government. There's a list of 42 skills, of which language is not one of them. Actually, language is one of them, but it's more of an ability to communicate. It's not necessarily a propensity to be able to pick up other languages. The literature that's out there on how important it is to speak a different language is kind of mixed. We did a survey a while back of Minnesota firms asking them, what do you really, in terms of doing international business, what do you regard as the primary skills necessary in a workforce? And really, languages were really low on the list. It was really things like, well, just a basic understanding of business came up most of the time, or a knowledge of regulations. Most employers actually told us all of our clients speak English, so we don't have any problems. One of the interesting notes on that slide, soon China will be the number one English-speaking country in the world. I think it's still important. I think it's important from a cultural perspective. As Tom noted, we're becoming a more and more diversified economy. I think from that perspective I mentioned earlier, that many of our technical people are going to have to start interacting directly with our clients. I think that's not just a knowledge of other languages, but simply a knowledge of other cultures is going to be essential.
Thank you. Representative Welty.
Thank you. I have a question for possibly our state demographer and then also yourself. And my first question is, can we look at Europe, especially the Western European countries, as where we're headed? I know for population demographics, as far as population pyramid, the United States is starting to get to more of a column instead of the pyramid. So can you comment on that? Is Western European, or are Western European countries, a good indicator of where we're headed?
Madam Chair, Representative Welty, right now the fertility rates in many of the European countries, not just West but also Eastern European countries, are very low, much substantially lower than they are in the United States. Our fertility rate is not at replacement, it's just a little bit below replacement level. In countries such as Italy, Germany, and France, it's closer to about 1.3 children per woman during her childbearing years, whereas here it's between 1.9 and 2, slightly more than 2 being replacement level. This is critical to the aging process since fertility rates below, a total fertility rate below approximately 2.1 children per woman is sort of the break-even point where a population begins to age in the long run. Basically, we're not producing enough children to replace ourselves. Much of Europe has seen substantial immigration of people from other countries over some time to fill in that labor force demand. Germany was perhaps the first, West Germany back then, was perhaps the first country to do that back in the 60s with the Gastarbeiter policy. And since then, that continues on throughout much of Europe. One of the issues, of course, just observing what has happened in, for example, France in the last year to year and a half is the degree to which the people that have immigrated to France for jobs and also to other countries, the degree to which they have been assimilated into the local population or have remained apart. I think there's also some concern in England and Italy and Germany and other countries for the same reason. I think the most recent concern was in Denmark, where there were some people that had grown up in Denmark of parents from another country were implicated in some terrorist activity or potential terrorist activity, and that became a concern as to how well populations had been assimilated into the local population. The immigration of foreign workers and their families has had a tendency to young the population. It's kept it younger than it would have otherwise been. Japan, by contrast, is a country where there's been virtually no immigration for the workforce, and Japan is a country that has experienced, their workforce has actually been declining in number since the late 90s, and their population is now declining in numbers, and some economists, Japanese and other economists, have drawn the relationship between that and their economic troubles. Japan's economy is literally getting smaller almost daily, and to a large extent that gets back to the decline in population and the decline in the labor force. It is still possible to grow an economy with even a declining workforce, but what that requires is a very steep slope of increasing per worker productivity at a very fast pace every year, and that can only be done with a highly educated workforce that is able to assimilate radical new technologies on a rapid pace.
Representative Walter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Gillespie, I can tell we could talk for hours about this, and I would definitely be interested in doing that as somebody who's had background in geography and human geography and taught geography before. I can relate to everything you're saying. And not only that, but just what you were describing is happening in some of the European countries. I can see happening in some of the communities I represent, or a community that I represent. And so my other question then would be for Mr. Uphoff. Are you at BEAD taking a look at what's occurring in on foreign countries and looking at our future workforce and how we're going to compete and how we're going to mimic what the other countries will be doing?
Madam Chair, Representative Welty, we have not actually undertaken any studies of other countries, being that we're one state among 50, we spend an inordinate amount of time comparing ourselves against the other 50 states. We tend to still see ourselves perhaps in competition against 50 other states for firms to move here. So we've pretty much kept to that level of analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Uphoff.
Representative Benson.
I'd like to follow up on that. Since you've been investigating in the states and our competitive relationship to them, do you have two or three or four things you've seen some of the our sister states do which have been successful in either attracting a more educated workforce or producing a more educated workforce? Or we know about the competition among the states to measure each other's industrial base, that kind of thing. But just talking about human capital, what kinds of things are other states doing that are kind of innovative? I've heard of Georgia with tuition support, that kind of thing. Is that pushing their education? Any other things?
Representative Chair, Representative Benson. I'll probably defer that mostly to Tom Gillespie. But what I would say is that right now, it's really more arts than science. Probably a lot of you are aware of somebody named Richard Florida who wrote a book called The Rise of the Creative Class.
Right.
And he basically says that economic development is going to follow this certain class of people who are highly creative and innovative. And so he kind of lists a whole variety of variables that he sees as being really important. This is an idea that's just very recently kind of being taken on by governments. So we're starting to think about things like natural resource amenities, things like that, just being able to live in a pleasing, entertaining sort of environment. So it's, in a way, it's actually kind of happening at very local levels, at the levels of cities who are developing their parks, trying to develop their schools, this sort of thing. Tom, did you have any comments on more of the policy sorts of issues?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, there's an international magazine called The Economist that last fall had a special edition on the international competition for talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is not just a 50-state competition, and in fact I believe it's an international competition. and that it is a competition that we can ill afford not to be competitive in. That we need to be able to attract bright, hardworking, well-educated, talented people from all over the country and from all over the world, and to avoid losing our best to other places. And that requires not just having jobs, but also an environment that that people like to live in, and an attractive place to live. Minnesota is not blessed by the warmest January climate in the country, but having been born and raised in places with palm trees, I prefer here. I'm a Minnesotan by choice, and I think there's a lot to be said. I've talked to many recruiters, and I don't have statistics on this, but I've talked to many recruiters around the state that have pointed out over the years that it is sometimes difficult to recruit a person to Minnesota, but once we have you here, we'll probably keep you. I think is a very positive kind of statement, but we need to ensure that that would continue.
So was it smart for the state to invest in the Guthrie Theater and the Twin Stadium and and to be more open and welcoming to people of different lifestyles, etc., as that book indicated?
Leave it to representation.
So those are the political issues, I guess.
Good question. Very good question. And I think that is a question we can contemplate, all of us. Thank you both so much. Excellent presentation. Members, excellent comments and questions. This is just such an enlightening discussion and information. And yet, on the other hand, it does create a sense of urgency, doesn't it? Excellent. So, thank you. Next, we are Mr. Uphoff talked about what we have in this state is very good, and we are so fortunate to have that as far as an education system. And so now we're going to have Commissioner Segrin come down and talk to us about kind of give us the state of the state address in regards to education, kind of. What is the state of public education, our high schools, I should say more specifically, in the state of Minnesota? And she is also going to talk a little bit about what are some of the redesign movement schools doing actually outright in our high schools. So, Commissioner Segrin, welcome to the committee, and I thank you for coming tonight. I know you had another commitment tonight, and you broke that commitment to be here with us tonight. And when I spoke to Commissioner Segrin about delving into high school redesign, she has been extremely supportive and excited, and I think you'll see this in her presentation. And she just really reiterated what an important, timely topic this is, and she would really wants to be an active participant. So we thank you for coming tonight.
Well, and certainly, Chairperson Dietrich, I really appreciate the opportunity to share what we are doing, and you will probably have some redundancy as far as some of the statistics tonight, but, you know, having some redundancy is probably good to, you know, keep reminding us of the challenges that we have before us and how we can look at opportunities to educate our children. What we have really looked at at the state of Minnesota is looking at our educational excellence that we have and talking about being nation-leading, but going from nation-leading to world competing. We can't assume that what we've been doing in the past is going to get us to the future. And so we've been looking at strategies to help us address those new issues. We know that dramatic job growth is projected to occur in the STEM disciplines in science, technology, engineering, and math in the future. If you look at these statistics, and some of these are probably a repeat of what Tom Gillespie and Mr. Uthoff mentioned, we know that by 2012 there'll be an increase, a 20% increase in jobs requiring at least some post-secondary education. In 1950, 80% of the jobs required no skills, but today's jobs are going to be are classified as skilled jobs, 85% of those. We know that in 2010 there will be jobs that don't exist today that we can't even anticipate. And that today's learners, when my students were, or my children were going to school, they were talking about that you were going to have a career or have a change in career 7 times in your lifespan. Well, now it's by the age of 38, 10 to 14 different jobs. So the rapidity of just what is happening in our workforce is really going to mean that all of our adults are going to have continual lifelong learning. And that economic forecasts project a 20 to 33% increase in the scientific and technological occupations in the next 10 years. This is just a bar graph that looks at the projected growth in a number of different areas, occupational areas. And you can see the different percentages all the way down to computer software engineers. And what's interesting is when we had the dot-com bubble explosion, if you will, people kind of avoided that field, and now we're finding out that there is a lot of demand for that has been pent up, and we need many more workers in those areas. Tom Friedman, in his book, said that we are simply not educating or even interesting enough of our own young people in advanced math, science, and engineering. And I want to talk a little bit about interesting students and the talents that we have as policymakers. To think about how we are going to create relevant educational opportunities for children. Just to give you just a quick overview of our MCA information in mathematics, you can look at the comparison between 2006 and 2007. We're basically holding steady. As you know, we have implemented new math standards that have been tested now for only the second year. They're much more rigorous, and then in about 5 more years, we will have our math revision that we're going through now, which will require Algebra 1 in 8th grade, Algebra 2 to graduate. So we will have another iteration of expectations for students. This is just another comparison. This breaks down the percentage of students that meet or exceed proficiency by ethnicity. I'm not going to go through those details, but you can look at those and look at the percentages. One thing that I will draw your attention to in mathematics, look at the comparison between Asian Pacific Islander students and the white population. I think that is a tribute to our educational system, that we have had a lot of Asian students coming from many different countries, and the success rate that they're now beginning to demonstrate. And I think that is a benefit and effect of our teachers that have been educating those students over the last 3 years. Reading, you can see the percentages there, holding relatively steady over the last 2 years. And again, the reading, you will see that, of course, for our English language learners, reading would be a little bit more difficult, so you see a little bit more of a decline in the minority populations, especially in the ELL population. The percent of students graduating in 2006, now this is the computation that is based on the 50-state compact through the National Governors Association. So this looks a little bit lower than the computation that we've used in the past. But even as you compare, whatever computation you look at, Minnesota still is in the upper 10 states, if not the upper 5 states, as far as graduation rates. So while this looks, you know, lower than what we've normally considered as our graduation rate, it is still very much in the top in the nation. Also, now this is looking at more national statistics, looking at the U.S., China, and India, and the comparison of the students that are enrolled in post-secondary and the numbers of students that are going into post-secondary. But that's at certainly the national level. If you look at the Minnesota college participation rates, however, you can see that in parens is the national average, and then you'll see the comparisons between the national and our state college participation, the retention, the graduation rates, etc. And we generally do better in most areas than at the national. We are slightly lower in our two-year school retention rates, but not by too much. When we look at our ACT participation this year, We are number one again. This is the third year in a row that we are number one as far as our ATC average scores. We also had an addition of 2,000 more students taking the ACT. So when we met with the ACT folks, they were really extraordinarily pleased and astounded that not only did we go up by 0.2%, which sounds like that's not very much, but also we had 2,000 more students participating in the ACT. So it'll probably be tough to keep maintaining that number one status. But I do feel like that is a tribute to, you know, some of the policies and things that we've been putting in place over the last few years, and I think we're now starting to see some indicators of success. However, we do have some areas of concern. You can see that in the black population and the Asian population either remain steady or decline slightly. But that's maybe not as much to worry about. If you have more students starting to participate, that's good news. So it's kind of this dilemma of getting more kids into the system, thinking about going to college and taking those admissions tests and stuff. So it needs to be, you know, taken with a little bit of a grain of salt. The percent of ACT tested students college ready. Now, the interpretation of college ready by ACT is if in all four subject areas that are tested in ACT, you have scored the percentage that ACT fields is an indicator of college success or readiness in the different subjects. So in language arts, they set a particular score. Same thing with math, science, etc. So if you look at all four subject areas, the numbers of students that have scored well in all of those to indicate college readiness, you can see the percentages there. So when you're looking at that, that's maybe a little bit more serious statistic. We also know that when we surveyed our students who participate in our EPASS system, and that's a program that is funded, it's adjunct to our ACT program. ACT runs it, and they have an explore and plan, kind of a pretest for ACT, but they also have a student survey and also an interest survey that students take. And when surveyed, the students in 2006, only about 11% in eighth grade indicated that they had any interest in science, technology, engineering, or math types of disciplines. And it doubled in the 10th grade area. But this is a cause for some concern if you only have those numbers of students that are interested. And it doesn't mean that they're going to end up being the white lab coat, you know, person, but, you know, any interest at all in those areas. So how do we prepare Minnesota students for an increasingly competitive 21st century workforce? We certainly, as I said, had a proud history in Minnesota of educating students to high excellence. But we can't rest on our past successes. We do need to, you know, think about strategies. One of the things that under our National Governors Association Honors Grant that we received 2 years ago was the requirement to create a Governors Education Council. Their charge was then to look at setting benchmarks and goals for our state that we could measure over time to report to the public and kind of check to see how we are doing. And so there was a prescribed a group of people that were to be part of this Governor's Education Council, and that represented higher education, K-12, and business interests in setting and discussing and setting these goals. So we decided to look at four areas. Core proficiency, which we basically just looked at the MCA, adequate yearly progress proficiency, but we felt like that was not really enough, you know, to really talk about the complexity of what we were doing educationally. So we also wanted to look at college readiness and rigorous course taking by our students, and over time measure what our children were doing in these two areas and seeing if there was movement in either going into college, etc. Graduation rates, we felt, was a very big indicator of whether students were graduating on time, you know, the dropout rate, etc. And then college success, and we wanted to measure those. So we kind of took a more comprehensive look at where we were going. And you can look at that report and that document via our website. We also created a communications program or process that also was part of our MCA Honors Grant. It was sort of one of those non-negotiables to really start to talk to the public, not only teachers and people that are in the field educating students, but also talking to the students and the parents about the importance of engaging their children in more science and math and some of the other corresponding career focuses. And I'll give you just an example. We went all over the state of Minnesota. And I personally, in my own family, I have a little granddaughter who's 9 years old. And I was encouraging her this summer to take a little summer camp. And it was just a morning program, 4 days a week, in science. And it was just a fun, you know, kind of get your hands dirty, make some goo, shoot up a rocket, you know, construct something that, you know, had an alarm system. There were several different kinds of things. And I must confess, I failed. I could not convince my little granddaughter to do this. She wanted to take horseback riding lessons, and she wanted to go to summer to soccer camp. And I must confess that even my daughter was saying, but Mom, she's really not interested in science. She really likes. And so I make that confession to share with you that I think it's really hard sometimes. And when I ask that question of, you know, an audience that I'm talking to, how many of these century students do math or science camp? And there's maybe one hand, and it's the science teacher's kid, you know. But most of us, you know, it's swimming, and it's not to diminish those important things, because they are all very important. My little granddaughter loves art, too. And, of course, I have a minor in art, so I encourage her in those areas, too. But the issue is that we have relied on a certain group of our students to kind of carry us through as far as the engineers that we need, as far as the mathematicians, the scientists, the next person's going to make the next greatest discovery. And we really have kind of, I think, almost forgotten or have not encouraged enough of our children to pursue science and math, and in doing so, they may not ever, you know, become a scientist or a mathematician, but in doing so, you also have creative, innovative people who in their own careers are probably going to add quite a bit. So I'm going to continue working on my little granddaughter. We will get her there. She loves the biology and the earth sciences, so we'll get her involved in some of those things. But we have been working a lot with parents and students to really try to create the understanding that it's very important and it's not something to be afraid of, that it is really something that can be a great opportunity of discovery for children. We had last year, of course, at the Science Museum, over 800 children that attended a very hands-on experience that was just extraordinary. We also had Sally Ride in, who, as you know, is the first American woman astronaut in space. And she has a particular emphasis on working with young women, ages 9 to 15. And in the afternoon, after she spoke to our superintendent, had a whole afternoon of sharing her experience as an astronaut and how she became interested in science and was a real encouragement. And we're hoping that we'll have some continuing relationships with her for our schools, particularly our middle school students. And then also, I will be going around, as I did last year, around the region, and we'll be having more STEM summits. And hopefully, if I'm in your area, we'll let you know. And we'll invite you to come. And also, perhaps, hopefully, you'll be able to share your encouragement with the teachers and parents and people that will be invited to those summits. We're also, of course, you know, the governor has proposed some new academic standard changes. Math standards, of course, have changed. I won't go through all that. You know those new changes. We just completed revising our math standards, and they are in the process of rulemaking now. And I thank you for the hearings that you did here on that and the process there. And then also, one of the wonderful, well, several things that happened this last legislative session, we have included another $6.5 million in the AP, IB, and College in the Schools program. And that is really fueling a lot of more rigorous course taking. Through the NGA Honors Grant, we were able to create what we call Lighthouse High School. And they're using action research to look at how to create rigor and relevance in the STEM and digital technology areas. We also have high schools that are looking at remediation strategies. If we are going to have more of our students engaged in science and math, we also need to come alongside of them and help them become successful. And if they are behind, we need to look at those strategies. We also have schools that are exploring industry certification processes, dual high school college type of thing on industry certification, getting kids engaged in the opportunity of earning an industry certification and then giving them a spark to say, I can do this. There's the opportunity to go on to more post-secondary education. And then we're also hoping that all of these things reinforce the relevance of the educational experience that kids have in high school. In regard to the advanced placement, we have some really wonderful good news for you here. We had a 16.9% increase from the 2005-2006 school year that are taking advanced placement courses and the test. And then in 2007, for the second consecutive year, we had double-digit increases again in the students that are participating. And what's really wonderful is not only the resources that we have given to the AP, IB, and College in the Schools has not only increased the numbers of kids taking the courses, but the scores on the tests, the numbers of students that are getting a 3 or better, have also increased in the double digits. So that's an incredible, incredible statistic to keep in mind. And when we met the AP folks, we blew the nation away. We were top again in the kinds of increases that we were seeing in the participation and the exam scores that are going on. Here's some statistics about the participation. You can look at those statistics as we go through. We also know that the impact of AP, and why are we doing this? You know, why did we choose AP, IB, College in the Schools? We know that students who take no AP courses have a 29% chance of completing a bachelor's degree. When they take one, their chances increase by 45%. And then if you take two or more, the likelihood increases to 61%. So that's research that backs up our rationale. The same thing goes for the IB programs. You can look at the participation there, and again, we have an increase in the numbers of students that are participating in the IB program. And also, we know that IBM students outperform their peers on state assessments, that IBM standards are aligned with best practice in education. They have a positive, IB has a positive impact on the culture of the school. They have higher acceptance rates in college, and the good news goes on. You all supported the funding for math and science academies for teachers. We are ramping those up. They will be starting up in January or early spring. We have a task force that is, you know, designing the implementation of that. We have both higher ed staff, teachers in the K-12 system, and others that are working to disseminate these best practice and professional development all around our region. And we're very excited about that. We're going to be starting with math first because of our because of the implementation of our math standards. We know that the most critical change will be in the middle school area in 6th and 7th grade and ramping up for Algebra 1 and 8th grade. And so we know that it's very important that we have the professional development right away for our students. In addition to that, we also have funded the Principals Academy, and many of you may have heard about that. We didn't have the house. Thankfully, we did see the value in that and did provide some money for it. The Senate did not, but we think the Senate is convinced to, and hopefully this year, this session will have some money to continue that.
We have 48 trainers, and we also have our first cohort of principals that are going through that. And it is very exciting, and it's a very comprehensive program, and we think it's very well needed. We also, just to give you an update on QCOMP, we have 38 school districts that are participating. I happen to know that we have 13 new ones in the pipeline that will be announced fairly soon, with another 7 after that. So we're continuing to see a lot of interest in the QCOMP program. We also have been fortunate to have a lot of business partnerships. And I do have to mention Thompson West and Minnesota High Tech Partners or Association. Quest is another partner that has just been wonderful, and 3M. Thompson West and Microsoft are working with us to create a clearinghouse for teachers and business people and higher ed, so that if teachers want to ask for, let's say, a scientist, an engineer to come into their classroom to do a demonstration on a particular area that they're teaching, they can go to this clearinghouse and find where in that region that there's somebody that is willing to come into their classroom. If it's a higher ed, if they would like a higher ed person to come into their classroom. If there is a business that would be willing to sponsor a math club after school, we're going to assemble that. And Thompson West has agreed to house that and to keep it up for the future. And we're very, very thrilled with that. And we're using some of the NCA money to get it started. But then Thompson West and Microsoft are going to be housing that for the future. Oh, thank you. That's been an extraordinary partnership. And that came out of our roundtables that we had at the statewide level when we had teachers and higher ed and businesses coming together. You know, businesses are saying, well, just call us up and, you know, ask us. And teachers are saying, you know, we don't really have a lot of time to be going out and prospecting in all of our communities with all of our businesses to say, do you have somebody that would come in? But it would really be nice if we had some place to go where you would list what you would be willing to do and what we need. And so we're very, very excited about that. We think it's a real common sense thing that's going to happen. And it, as I said, it will provide opportunities for job shadowing for teachers, for students, mentorships, internships, etc. And also I'll mention the PTC gift. I think you all know about that. That is a company that is provides some of the most of the software that engineers use for computer-aided design. Most of our large companies, if not all of our companies, have some kind of engineering capacity. Medtronic, 3M, General Mills, Toro, Caterpillar, John Deere, Lockheed Martin, and then the list goes on to smaller engineering companies that use PTC ProEngineer software. And they came in and said, we would be glad to provide the software, 300 of the software packages to every teacher who got trained in using the computer-aided design software. They will upgrade it continually if there's new iterations of it, and the teachers can use it, math, science, technology, and art teachers can use it to look at how they can expose students to using computer-aided design, and it happens to be the software that many of our engineering companies are using. So the kids are not going to become engineers using it, but they're going to be exposed to a software that they can kind of experiment with and learn and have some success with as they're going through their classes. That's the end of my presentation. We have been very busy at the Department of Education, focused on STEM, and we're very committed to making sure that our students have the most rigorous and relevant opportunities. We feel like the Teacher Math and Science Academies are going to give us a lot of opportunities to look at the relevance part of it. We are also working in partnership with the Science Museum. They received money from the legislature plus 3M, and they are doing some really exciting work in the science area, and we will be partnering with them so that we're not duplicating, but that we're all providing as many, many opportunities as we possibly can for teachers to get the kind of really state-of-the-art professional development that they possibly can. I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions from members? Representative 12.
Thank you, Commissioner Segrin. As always, you're so articulate, and it makes me very, very proud to be a teacher in Minnesota. I just wanted to ask a question about the Texas model. I had the opportunity in April to join with other legislators in Texas when the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation brought us down there to look at what Texas is doing in terms of their P16 model. I think we get into kind of a rut here talking about K-12, and I believe the last thing you talked about, the private and public partnership, is really what is going on in Texas. But I was visiting with Chancellor McCormick this summer, and I was just so excited about what they're doing in Texas, and there was this kind of an aha moment between the two of us that perhaps our colleges and university systems are not communicating with the public schools or with the Department of Ed as vigorously as they are doing in Texas, where the partnerships between business, higher ed, and the pre through P-12, really different terminology in another state. But it seems to me like you're talking about that very model, but how vigorously are we working with the college and university systems in order to get them aligned with expectations for... Am I asking this question coherently?
Yes, you
okay,
are. And actually, thank you for asking that question,
okay.
Because I think we are working very vigorously with Chancellor McCormick and the Minsky system and President Brunix. In fact, we have a P16 roundtable or partnership that is very active. It was created about 4 years ago. And the last 2 years I was the chair of the P16 partnership. We have 6 work groups. And one of the things that both the Chancellor and I have talked a lot about is, and we are actively working on this, and so is President Brunix and myself, talking constantly about how we can have more robust connections. One of the examples is the STEP program in Anoka Heads, and I think you all, and well, Representative Dietrich certainly knows about that program. But the Chancellor would like to create more of those opportunities for students. You know, we certainly are talking about dual credit, early college. The Chancellor is very interested in early college concepts. You know, we're talking about students that, you know, having many opportunities. Jenny Krabowski, I think, has been probably before your committee, who is in charge of the STEP program, and, you know, talking about what is the value of a student being, you know, having the opportunity to earn some dual credit? And is this for all kids? Yes, it is. And can all kids, you know, kind of get that spark then if they are working on whatever the opportunity is? So we are working very robustly with them. One of the things that we are creating is a student ID tracking system, if you will. You know, we've got the MARS system here that all of our students have an ID number, and we're going to be extending that to higher ed, so all students who stay here in the state of Minnesota, whether it's public or private, will be able to see, you know, what's happening. We'll be able to do lots of research and sharing of data between our two systems to make sure that we're preparing kids for higher ed and that they are, you know, sharing what they know. We have a very active partnership. When we created our math revision, higher ed was deeply involved. And in fact, Dr. Larry Gray from the University of Minnesota, who's the head of the math department at the university, was our co-chair of our math revisions. We had many people from higher ed that we're talking with about what are the expectations for college, you know, from all the many disciplines. We know that, you know, we can't have math standards that are focused only on those engineers or IT people, but what are the fundamental strong college readiness standards that we need to create? So we have many, many partnerships, and we will be continuing that. We have active discussions with that. Now, President Brunix will be we have rotating chairmanship between Chancellor McCormick, myself, and President Brunix. We have all the educational organizations represented, plus business and foundations. And he is now, we've gone through kind of a review of what we've been doing, where we are going to go next. with our partnership. What are the urgent needs? We will be continuing to focus on STEM. We're all committed to that. And also to how we prepare our kids in even a more robust liberal arts way, too. We can't forget about writing skills. We can't forget about the other liberal arts things that are important for children, too. But I want to assure you that we are, we probably have one of the most functional and productive P16 partnerships in the nation. And I say that very modestly, because when I talk to other states and, you know, what is happening, they don't have as good a relationship with their heads of their institutions. They have multiple universities. We're kind of unique in Minnesota in that we've got, you know, the public Minsky system and the privates, and so we've got kind of three heads that we can kind of work at, where you may have multiple presidents that you have to, you know, kind of work through and facilitate. So we've got a very good working relationship and very excited about the partnership. And
thank you, Commissioner Segrin. And Representative Swells, we will have the P16 committee come and testify before this group in, I think, about 6 weeks or so, I think is what we've got it mapped out for. But excellent question, and I'm very anxious to hear more about your experience in Texas and what you learned.
Yeah, in Texas, I will say, excuse me, Madam Chair, but Texas also, we looked at Texas as in some of the things that they were doing with some of their high school redesign, some of their, they have some academy or high school focus. So we actually did look at Texas. I was on a panel with them here probably back around 6 months ago, and we really have had a lot of discussion with them also.
Representative Tilbury.
Yes, I'm really glad that both Dr. Gillespie and Commissioner Al Segrin was here tonight, because I have a couple of questions, and one I have to get answered from Tom first, if possible, and then another one for you, Alice, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
The one is about a slide that said over the next 10 years, Minnesota will need more than 56,000 new teachers, or 37%, to account for growth and turnover, and that's one of the slides that you had. Was that accounting for the number of teachers that exit the field within the first 5 years of their career?
Dr. Gillespie.
Madam Chair, Representative Tilbury, that particular quote is actually from the Department of Employment and Economic Development as part of their occupation specific forecast out 10 years, that 10 years that Mr. Uphoff talked about in more general terms, and that relates to turnover generally, which includes, for example, people leaving the occupation, people leaving the state, people dying, people dropping out of the workforce, and people retiring. Basically, turnover from all causes versus new growth in the number of jobs, and most of the new job openings in teachers, according to that, and most of the other analysis I've seen, will be due to retirements and other turnovers. However, I believe the Department of Education has a much more specific database that I was not referring to, that I think is fairly impressive in terms of the tracking specific teachers and the turnover. And I should turn that over to Commissioner Segrin.
Well, thank you, Commissioner Segrin. And I don't have those statistics with me tonight, but we'll be glad to bring those statistics to you. We also track, you know, sort of the prediction of shortages, you know, based on, you know, lots of surveying and things that we're seeing in the field. Certainly the loss of teachers after 4 or 5 years is really one of the more concerning issues, and how do we retain teachers. We also, yesterday, I participated with MREL, which is one of our laboratories that, you know, is created by the federal government, and their whole day was spent on teacher on the teacher of ed process and where we're at with that, and how do you address shortages, and what are they doing about, you know, kind of the demand side of teaching. And so we had a very interesting discussion yesterday about that. But we also have a lot of declining enrollment in Minnesota, and that's the other thing. We've got a lot of teachers who probably are not working now because, you know, they have been laid off. And, you know, so that plays a factor in, you know, maybe the demand. But the teacher at Ed College has said that they also educate so many more teachers that go out of our state. You know, so it's not just about our state, but it's, you know, the demand, and there's such a demand in some states, Arizona being an example, that they can't hire enough teachers fast enough. So you've got these, you know, pockets of high demand, and then other states that are aging, and you have different demographic effects. The other thing that we talked about, too, was teachers used to go into the profession and, you know, expected to stay there 30 years. And we're also seeing a trend where, you know, people may stay in the profession for a while, but then may move on to other professions, or may, after a career in the private sector, want to come in to teaching. And they had quite a robust discussion about how do we attract maybe mid-career changers and bringing them in, that it may be a different kind of job career, if you will. Talked about portability of retirement, you know, and that may have an effect in the future on bringing in people for 10, 15 years into the educational profession, and then they may move on, or, you know, as I said, come in from a private career. So you've got kind of some different dynamics that may be going on in the future that are kind of hard to predict at this point.
Thank you. Members, in interest of time, oh, I'm sorry, Representative Benson.
Well, I just want to follow up on that, because I was one of those persons who spent like 35 years in the classroom. Looking at the numbers of new teachers that we're going to have to recruit, especially in math and science, your discussion about the math and science academies, I think, is going in the right direction. That is a useful thing. Maybe portability of retirement is another. What other kinds of things would you propose that we do to restructure? I just feel that the education profession as such is kind of been left behind and has not changed. Mm-hmm. I can't say it really changed at all in the 35 years that I spent in the classroom. And I just don't think that's going to work any longer in the future. That people have too many other opportunities. Mm-hmm. And we really need to attract people who are knowledgeable about this subject to the matter, but also the kinds of persons who can inspire kids. Mm-hmm. And we don't just find those people around willy-nilly. And that's the reason I'm interested in this committee, because it's a committee of working group on high school redesign.
Mm-hmm.
And I, other than the ideas of these academies, I haven't heard much from anyone, really, on any fundamental redesign which would attract people into the profession and keep them for a reasonable period of time, certainly more than 4 or 5 years.
Well, and that's really key. I think we talked yesterday about teachers that come out of, you know, a teacher vet college, and you can't expect them to, you know everything right out of that. It's like any profession, mm-hmm. that you're trained in. There's going to be a period of time before you really become comfortable and competent in your field. But to the extent that we have excellent people coming out, and then they can continually be professionally developed. I hear that over and over, that it's not about the salary, except that I do think we need to address the beginning salary issue. I don't think we're going to be able to compete with the private sector unless we don't. But that gets into a lot of other issues about salary structure, etc. But they do need the support, the mentoring, the induction opportunities. I think we need to really be thinking about, you know, at the national level, there's been a lot of, and it's not true in our state, where you have, you know, very unqualified, even without licensures, being thrown into very poor, hard-to-educate class, you know, children that are very hard to educate. And We don't have as much of that, but you still do have the seniority where, you know, you paid your dues, and so I get to choose to go into a classroom that's maybe not as challenging. And so those are all the kind of fundamental things that we're looking at. But I really do think our generation X, Y, or Z, or whatever we're talking about now with our new generation, because they have so many opportunities and they're going to be trained so much differently, and we should be training or educating our children in more profoundly different ways.
Mr. Stegman, I have a question for you in regards to that. That's an excellent question and some excellent comments. Is the P16 group taking a look at this? Because, you know, this might be a politically incorrect statement to make, but I've just continually had this observation. Should a professional, a person, you know, who wants to be a professional, who goes into the college of education, becomes a teacher, has 4 years of college education, should they need instantaneous retraining? I mean, isn't 4 years of college not enough? Because I think you need to continue to have staff development. But and I don't think we need to answer that question right now. But I think the higher education needs to take some responsibility for that.
We talked about that yesterday too.
Oh, good.
So we talked about you know the students that are hired after they come out and having that feedback and the discussion. I don't think it's as much about retraining. It's just it's the support as you're in that classroom that you've been thrown into, whether it's middle school, high school, or little kindergarten kids running around like little crazy. You can mentally picture that in your mind and what to expect, but until you've really lived it, you may think you were going to control this situation pretty well, or you had your lesson plans all okay, and today I was going to do these three things and nothing happened, and the next day nothing happened, and then pretty soon you're panicked. So I think it's more of, being able to have a mentor, somebody that you can talk to that can work you through those and kind of, help you. It's not necessarily about retraining, but it's getting you off to a good start. Some teachers have no problem at all that come out, but others, may struggle more. But then after that, 2 or 3 or 4 year period, I think, and it's not for just, it's every teacher I need to have continual, really meaningful professional development where they can get together, where you can look strategically at data. Another thing we talked about is that teachers, and I thought this was kind of a no-brainer, but that teachers need to be taught how to do formative ongoing assessment all the time in their classroom. Now, I'm talking to some pretty darn good teachers here, so I think you're going to be shaking your heads and going, of course I know how to do that. But where you're, you've taught a lesson, you analyze how the students have responded, certain students may not have gotten it, how do you adjust, how do you help those students, how do you, if everything went over everybody's head, that continual assessment, reassessment of what you're doing. And I said, well, isn't that a fundamental thing that teachers should be doing? And it was sort of like, well, so there's lots of really rich discussion that needs to be taking place. And I didn't answer your question fully. I think we should be looking at kids if they are ready to, if they've met the graduation requirements, and unless we're providing them with some kind of really robust enrichment that's going to take them to, the college level, why don't we let them go? But if we've got kids that, maybe need to have a little more help, we're just in such a mechanical way of treating our kids. All kids must go to 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. If you haven't gotten it by 12th, or if you've gotten there before 12th, you still have to stay there. There's so many different things, and I would just love to have a lot of big brainstorming sessions. And it's hard for us to get out of our boxes. It's hard for me sometimes to think outside of the box. But we really do need to think about it. And I don't necessarily think that Japan and China and India have all the answers either, because if you get into their systems, it's pretty rigid, and of course, they have a sorting process. In China, after 9th grade, if you didn't make it, you didn't make it. That's the end of your potential.
Thank you for those the honest and reflective comments.
We are going to move on. And I'm sorry, did you have another question?
No, that's all right. I was just going to say that the students are in this lockstep, but so are the teachers many times and professional people. And that 19th century factory model has to fundamentally change in some way. And that's how I see it. The system we have shoves the largest number of children through the smallest economic hole you can get them through, I think. And I think if we want to get into the finances and all that, except I would say we have 91 districts in the state of Minnesota seeking referenda this year. We know that we have some fundamental problem here. And every industry and every business, I think, has to have sufficient budget to produce the products that the consumers want. And that doesn't really fit with high school design directly, but I think if we're to make some fundamental change in this regard, there is an economic component, and we just as well face it.
Well, and I will just respond. Boy, I would just love to be able to just sit down sometimes to just talk instead of having this formal process. But we also are guilty of not looking at what we have been doing and getting rid of some of the dusty old things we're doing and retooling. We tend to want to just put things on top of. And I think we also need to really give ourselves a hard look at what we're willing to give up. And I don't even mean give up. I mean just get rid of some of the things that are just not relevant anymore. And, you know, we tend to love some of our favorite things. But if we're really, business does the same thing. They don't manufacture money either. And if they're competing, they have their constantly retooling and readjusting and seeing where they will let go of a process here and start doing something differently. So, but, you know, it takes resources also, but I think they need to be deployed critically and creatively. And
thank you. Is anybody here thinking of the analogy of the cheese at any point tonight? I'm just putting a plug in for my little book again. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank
excellent.
You. Nice being with you.
And I'm sure we will have you back again. And I'm and we will continue to have these discussions. We have decided in this committee that we would like to hear from at least one high school each meeting because, as you can tell by the work that the department has done and because of just the nature of our state, we do have schools who have engaged in some level of redesign. And so we want to hear from those schools so that we make sure that we are giving an honest assessment of where we are at. And so tonight we have, the principal from Irondale High School, Colleen Wambach.
And I didn't prepare an overhead
no,
or a PowerPoint or anything. I found out about this today.
Very short notice, and we very much appreciate you coming
tonight. Well, it would be casual.
It is.
I could just talk about some of the things that we're doing at Irondale.
Please do.
I think part of high school redesign is redesigning the way we work. You know, there are other parts to redesign and things we all need to think about, but part of it is about the way we work. And we've been doing some things at Irondale, and we're starting to see some significant results from that. And what started, it has actually been a 5 to 7 year process. It started a number of years ago with a negotiated agreement with our bargaining unit for teacher leaders, instructional leaders, not department chairs, but instructional leaders. Those leaders got some training, formal training in how to do leadership, and we talked about roles, responsibilities, boundaries, etc., and set about trying to define what good instruction was and what strategies worked best. And quickly realized that we really didn't have any measures at the classroom level other than letter grades and gut instinct for knowing what we thought was good. And we were working with, a lot of our work was based on that of Rick Dufour, who's done a lot of work with professional learning communities and is from Illinois. I was at a workshop he did, and I said, how do you get to the kind of analysis that you're doing with some of the common assessments teachers are doing at the classroom level? He told us about that software. Our district went ahead and purchased that, and we have someone on site who helps with staff development and instructional technology, and she is able to help the staff use that software and pull from it the most salient things that they need to look at results and make instructional decisions from those. The first department that really grasped that was the math department, into data and wanting to look at all the results. And 4 years ago, they did a pretest. They created their own pretest. They weren't happy with their MCA scores. They thought they should be better. They all agreed that that assessment was a good assessment of what they thought kids should know and be able to do in math, and that everything should be aligned to that, and that their scores were not as good as they thought they could be. So they developed their own pretest, gave it to everybody, used the software to analyze it, did some things, retooled their curriculum, and, you know, put together some warm-up problems, etc., and their scores went up. The following year, our English department, who was very slow getting on board with this kind of process, got 3 stars. We were 4 stars in math and 3 stars in reading, or I can't remember. And the English teacher said, we're not a 3-star school. I said, well, you know, how do you know? What do you know about the kids and the way they scored? And they didn't know anything. So they anything specific about how to get to raising that. And so they agreed to do the same process that the math department had done and put together their own assessment. When they got the results of that, we gave it to all 9th and 10th graders, and those two grades didn't score. Their scores were essentially the same, which brought up all kinds of red flags. And so they started talking about retooling and looking at what they were doing with language arts, especially reading in 9th and 10th grade, reading and writing. At the same time, some White House grants came out. We applied for one of those and got it, and put some real focused time and effort into reviewing that curriculum in 9th and 10th grade and starting to rework it. We targeted, that was 2 years ago, those kids are in 11th grade now. Targeted that group of kids and then followed them into 10th grade, and their scores are going up. And I'll get to that in a minute. A couple years ago then, the STEM grants came out, and we were looking at doing some things. We knew that our group coming into 9th grade last year, because our district does NWEA assessments and has patterns of achievement with the kids, we knew we were getting a group that had some significant issues both in reading and math, but a growing population of kids that had significant issues. And so we applied for one of the STEM grants for transition, moving from 8th grade to 9th grade, and targeted the bottom quartile of kids to see if we could have an impact on that group of students, and instituted the use of clickers, classroom response systems, with that group to see if targeting efforts and using their clickers the kids use to respond to items, if that would increase engagement and bring up, you know, achievement. And what we got from that last year was that the math students had, in that bottom quartile, had a 1% growth semester 1 and 14% growth semester 2 over the same quartile of kids the previous year. And in science, there was 4% growth because they instituted the same plan, semester 1 and 5% semester 2. And what was interesting with that was the science teachers got the clickers after the math teachers did, and the math teachers used them a lot more because they had them at the beginning of the year. So we're starting to see all these things come back and seeing some increases in achievement. When we got our MCA scores, the headline in the paper said, you know, scores remain steady. And so I dug in and started, you know, looking at ours. Our math scores went up by 18%. We had 40% students proficient on the math exam last year, and we had 58% proficient this year. Edina and Mountview High Schools had higher scores than that, but nobody else did. Even, you know, other schools with similar demographics, we were listed at that point with 17% students on free and reduced lunch. Our reading, we went up 12%, so went from 67 to 78%, and again outscored schools with similar demographics. So, you know, we felt like the earth had shifted a bit. We were all pretty excited. And then the ACT scores came out, and those were up in all strands, all categories of that. We also had 12 National Merit semifinalists this year. We have never had that many. So we're pretty pleased. And I was waiting for another shoe to drop, but I asked our superintendent and our testing coordinator to dig in a little bit and see if we really should be doing cartwheels or not. And they said, yeah, they went in and looked at, oh, it's two grades of kids whose scores went way up. They went in and looked at this group of kids to see if they indeed had scored higher over the years. That group of merit scholars, you know, they've always been at the top. But this cohort of kids has not. They've scored the same as other groups in the past. So they really feel, and so do I, that it's the result of the work that the teachers are doing at Irondale. The other thing that happened with our reading efforts, I have to say, too, is QCOMP. About the time, well, the Lighthouse grant came out, we had targeted reading, and we knew we were going to be in trouble with reading if we didn't get busy and do something different, because what we were doing wasn't working. The Lighthouse grant helped get some people, you know, to sit down and really work on it and look at it, and they won't do that unless they have some additional resources, because they're working hard all day and don't want to take extra things on. But then QCOMP came in at the same time, and I felt like the stars were aligning for us, because the MDE wanted our district to do a common goal across the grades, and what they decided to work on, what statistically was, you know, common across grades, was word meaning. And so everybody had to work on word meaning. Everybody had to write a measurable goal. We were trying to get everybody to write SMART goals using the data from their common assessments to increase achievement and set measurable targets. That really forced everybody on the train in doing that. It also, we started an effort with reading across the content areas. So everybody in the building, we have two school improvement goals. One is to increase achievement as demonstrated on summative and formative assessments. And then they all have to write SMART goals towards that. And the other one is to increase reading achievement. And so it's not just the English department, but it was a school-wide effort that I think the grants that came through MDE have helped us out considerably.
Thank you, and I would say that supports the statement by Representative Benson, is that resources are needed. You need to...
they are.
Yeah. It becomes important.
You need instructional leaders, because the principal can't do all of it, and I don't know all the content areas. I can work with them and do some leadership, but you need instructional leaders, and they need some pay for that, or they aren't going to do it. I think that QCOMP has helped a number of districts with that also. You need enough support staff to, you know, get kids in the right, help get kids in the right place and work with them and push them to the most rigorous things they can do. You need resources for software. We would not be doing this. There's been some training provided on how to use spreadsheets to do this, and we tried that 5 years ago, and it's too much for a lot of people. But if you have software, the software we have, teachers, if they do a Scantron, can run the Scantrons, and by the time they go back to their room, it's web-based, they can pull everything up by strand, by subgroup, by, item analysis. That report gets used a lot.
Very interesting. You just have to have.
But yeah, you have to have resources.
Well, and you've obviously targeted your resources in the areas that were effective to raise your test scores that much. That's very impressive. There were a lot of other schools that wish they could have boasted of that type of...
and then our study did pass a year ago. So between test scores and the fact that people know they aren't going to get cut, or probably won't get cut unless we are a declining enrollment district, but the general mood is wonderful this fall.
Congratulations. Yeah. That is exciting, and you're right, the stars were aligned. Many, and as you keep talking, you can see that many of the stars were aligned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, excellent work, and thank you for coming tonight on such short notice.
Sure. Thank you.
Members, we were going to talk about the book, Who Moved My Cheese, but in interest of time, I'm afraid nobody will ever come back if I keep you much longer than this. So I am going to go ahead and during the meeting.